Hello, welcome back to the Drinking Liberally podcast, the show that combines good alcohol with some friendly political banter. I'm your host, Kevin Wilson, and this week I am joined by a guest that wears a great many hats. She is a stand-up comedian, a writer, an author, and even dabbles in podcasting herself, Selena Kopic.
Yes, hi, Selena. Hey, Kevin.
How are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing great myself. Trying to stay sane in this world.
Yeah, I know. I was like, yeah, great. I mean, I'm doing as well as can be expected.
I think this is the one time you're actually allowed to be truthful about that question. When people ask you, like, how are you doing? You can actually say, you know, not so great.
I know. And I do, like, I'm a very just, like, upbeat, bubbly person. And so sometimes I just, my instinct is to be like, great. And then I'm like, oh no, I don't want people to think that I'm not also, like a part of what's going on and upset by police brutality. You know, it's like, Selena, maybe you don't come off as too happy because like, these are very dark times and strange times.
Those are literally all the thoughts that were going through my head as we were having that back and forth right there. But I'm happy you're able to join. We're going to get to know Selena a little bit better over some drinks today. And discuss the current events going on in the world. But first, we're going to discuss what we're actually drinking before we dive into some of the more personal stuff. So today's beer is the Melon Wheat Ale from Shipyard Brewing Company out of Portland, Maine. This beer, it pours a pretty golden clear with a just tiny little foam head on it. Something that actually concerned me, you can smell the watermelon like the second you raise your glass. And that worried me a bit because I thought the taste was going to be insanely sweet and chemical in nature. But I'm happy to report that that is not the case. It does strike a pretty good balance between the watermelon flavor. And you actually do get some of that weedy grain type flavor from the ale itself. So I'm glad this wasn't like drinking a liquefied Jolly Rancher, which a lot of these fruit flavored beers, I think, tend to go in that direction.
It's easy to end up with that, especially with watermelon. Like, watermelon's just like, it's not really I feel like it's hard to have it be a subtle flavor. I mean, I love the flavor of watermelon, whether it's like the trashy fake version or a more real one.
Sure, yep.
But like, but yeah, it seems like it's probably hard to like keep your foot off the gas with the watermelon.
Absolutely. Yeah, I could see this going either way. So it's impressive that they struck the balance that they did. Honestly, not much else to say about this beer. It's got a pretty light mouthfeel. It's 4.4% alcohol by volume. So it's really a pretty good summer beer for a hot summer day. I think it's nationally shipped at this point at a Shipyard. So you can probably find this at your local store. It's the Shipyard Brewing Company Melon Wheat Ale. I recommend you pick some up and bring it to the parks now that some of them are opening up again.
And since that's the only thing to do, yeah. I feel like all I do is drink outdoors. You know?
I mean, there are worse things in the world.
I know. I've been joking around with friends. It's like, who would have thought that a pandemic would end up with like this much picnicking and like outdoor roaming around booze in? It's so strange.
Yeah, absolutely. So what do you have for us today? What do you have on your end?
I am drinking a Sauvignon Blanc. And actually, it's a white wine spritzer, which I'm trying to remember if I had the same thing the last time I was on your pod. I think last time it was just probably a Sauvignon Blanc because I love it. But yeah, I love a white wine spritzer because it's most like, I mean, and you can, you know, you can kind of decide the ratio you want of wine to just like bubbly water. It's a Sauvignon Blanc. It's my favorite one, Oyster Bay. You can find it at most wine stores. It's pretty available now. I fell in love with it. I started loving this one because we had it at both my sister's weddings, and it was always for sale in the Boston area, but I think they have better distribution now. And then I just combined it with some LaCroix because what else do we drink? I was legally required to as a white woman. but so it's just with a little passion fruit LaCroix. And I love Sauvignon Blanc. It's my favorite of all the white wines.
Awesome.
Just nice, a little like, you know, flowery. And I like it better than Pinot Grigio or a Chardonnay. Like Chardonnay, I find too sweet. Pinot Grigio, I find like it's just not interesting enough. It's Sauv Blanc. It's sort of nice and flowery.
Now, do you rotate between whites and reds? Do you have a preference?
I do somewhat. I kind of love a red. I mean, I joke around like red before bed, you know, white when it's light. but yeah, so I mean, and I love a red with like a steak dinner. But if, you know, it's pretty relatively early in the late afternoon, evening right now. So I tend to, when I'm like kind of moving from work gear into hanging out gear, you know, switching gears or whatever. I tend to like a white to do that just because I feel like it's nice. It doesn't pack too much of a punch. A red sometimes just makes me sleepy.
totally understand that. Okay, so white's your transition beer. Nice. Transition yes. wine.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Selena, cheers.
Yes, cheers.
And we're going to get to know you a little bit better, find out what kind of makes you tick politically. So just got a couple of questions for you. I guess the top one, and I know you answered this the first time you came on the pod, but that was probably a year ago. So let's let's start fresh, see if anything's changed. Mm-hmm. What are some of your top voting issues? What does a candidate have to support to get your vote?
Yeah, I mean, in the past, it was always abortion rights, because I just think for women, the right to reproductive freedom is baked into the right to financial freedom, economic freedom, career advancement. I'm a lifelong Democrat, and I find it interesting and strange that there are some Democrats out there who are anti-choice, you know. I mean, it's very few and far between, but some really are. And I admire some Democrats like Tim Kaine who are willing to say, like, hey, you know, abortion is not for me. I would not, me and a partner would not have one, but I think it's important for it to be legal for others. That's like kind of a make or break issue for me. I used to be kind of black and white about politicians and politics, I think. And I feel like I've sort of opened up more in the past year, maybe, just because in this election season, I wasn't gunning for anyone. I just sort of let it unfold. I knew I was going to support the nominee no matter who it would be. So I was like, no one really spoke to me that much. I did find it interesting what kind of appealed to me. You know, I really admire that Kamala Harris has such a great resume and track record of working in difficult situations and with bureaucratic machines mm-hmm. and making a difference. I do think she's pretty misunderstood in that way. Some people I know, like, a make or break is, you know, whether a candidate would take money from certain interest groups. I mean, to be honest, I don't know why, but like I think taking money from like financial firms or whatever, that doesn't make such a big difference to me. I think taking NRA money and gun lobby money, I find pretty gross, very gross. But, you know, when people, you know, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders were like, oh, you know, no corporate sponsorship or whatever. And I think sometimes you're kind of cutting off your nose to spite your face. Like,
sure.
You know, like Trump, it has so much money coming his way from, you know, so many places. It just seems like I hate it when Democrats will sort of like have this purity contest of like, you know, I just think you're really shooting yourself in the foot. So that kind of stuff didn't really matter to me when different candidates were like, oh, well, here's my plan on how I'm going to fundraise or whatever. I just feel sort of like take your money where you can get it. And unless it's coming from really dark, dark sources like the NRA or the gun lobby. I don't know. So I also feel like this is very like kind of I'm all over the place.
No worries.
But yeah, I guess reproductive freedom and I would say government experience too. Like that's something I don't like. Andrew Yang never appealed to me because I was like, dude, I mean, apparently he has interesting ideas, but I do think there is some value in not having a politician who's learning on the job. Like, you know, I mean, I see this in my job too. Like sometimes you just need someone who knows how things work and why they work and the hoops you have to jump through, even if you think the system is dumb, but this is just how it has to get done. You know, I think there's a lot of value in that.
Yeah, I would love to see that argument put to bed forever. The whole experience in government argument, because, man, I think about my own job and how long it's taken me to get, you know, my feet under me. And I don't have, you know, the free world at stake
exactly.
as a responsibility.
Exactly. I know. I mean, I was thinking about that with regard to police brutality recently and how, you know, just I was just reading somewhere, I think it's for police training is something like 840 hours.
Depending on the department. Sure.
Yep. Yeah. And then cosmetology training is like 1,500 hours, you know, like, I mean, I think about, my work in publishing too. Like there's a lot of stuff that I just learned on the job and, you know, I majored in English, but like, I learned about the machinations of publishing on the job, but like with policing, that cannot be the case. Like, you know, of course you gain experience on the job and you know, like, oh, this other time I did it, this didn't work or whatever, but there should be such intensive training, you know, like, and there should be retraining every 2 years, professional development. Like I mean, teachers have that constantly. Like, mm-hmm. how do cops not really have any of that? It's crazy.
Yeah, I think, and hopefully we'll see some of that change. We'll get to that a little later. But you're right. I saw those stats, too, about the number of hours on average across the country, and that just blew my mind. I'm like, yeah. I can't believe that. And maybe we do need to have some kind of formal certification.
Yeah.
You know, across the country.
Exactly. And I feel like I know some people who would probably call me like a damn Republican for saying this, but like, I think that there is such a lack of training in de-escalation tactics, mm-hmm. but also a sense that cops can get away with whatever they want. So like, you know, do this hold that's illegal, but do it anyway, you know? But yeah, it just seems like, I don't know, the least that could be done is some more further training and accountability and, you know, educating people in conflict resolution. And, you know, I mean, yeah, someone on Twitter was saying, they're like, you know, every bartender I know is better at like conflict resolution than every cop, you know, and sure. It's true. Like, I mean, I know so like I live right, you know, downstairs and around the corner from a bar, and my buddy George works there. And like, you know, he closes on his own sometimes. And the amount of times that he's had to politely get a drunk monster out of the bar, but without making the guy want to burn the place down, right. You know, like, God, I just, yeah, I think, you know, with better account, more accountability and a really move toward intensive training, I think that could change things.
Yeah, I agree. So it's a safe bet that based on those two major topics, you're not a Donald Trump voter.
No. Oh my. In fact, like, I always thought, you know, when he was elected, I remember I woke up that morning screaming. And while I checked my phone, I saw that he had won. Because I went to bed thinking he was, you know, like the writing was on the wall. But I went to bed crying and praying, woke up, looked at my phone and, you know, started screaming. Because then somebody tweeted at me immediately to make fun of me, which was like, cool way to be Trump.
Yeah,
fan.
Thanks. Yeah.
But yeah, like, I mean, it's so literally, I thought I would get used to it somehow. But every time I even hear the phrase President Trump, I'm like startled. like, how is this real? This is like the premise for a terrible 80s movie, you know, like yeah. The biggest shitbag liar, New York City, you know, fake magnate in the world is president. It's insane. And I know, Kevin, you're not a Trump guy, right?
On a podcast called Drinking Liberally? No. Absolutely not.
I just always want to, I mean, because, you know, admittedly, I mean, I think Trump is terrible. And I think a lot of his followers, you know, I think they fall into two camps. Either they, you know, bought the bullshit he was selling, or, you know, they're terrible people. Like, I just... You know, I try to even have a little space for people who I think were misled by him, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I think there's a woman I know, and, like, as I've gotten to know her more, I'm like, oh, I think she voted for Trump, and she's a great, like, I like her a lot. She's great, you know? And so I'm like, okay, you just never know.
Yeah, it's tough. I for sure have family members that voted for Trump. A lot of them won't admit it anymore, but for sure voted mm-hmm. for them. So you've done a lot of work as a stand-up comedian. Mm-hmm. I'm curious as to how you've been able to handle the Trump administration as a stand-up. So, like, I imagine it's rife for ripping on, but do you try to stay away from political topics, or is that really what you were able to hone in on?
I generally stay away from political topics. My overall theory in comedy for me is I am silly, I am high energy. I want to like kind of crank things up to 11, comment on like the absurdity of things, be, you know, super inclusive as best I can, you know, always punch up, you know, be in the struggle myself, you know, try to not be seen as mocking people who don't deserve it. So I generally just avoided it. But I did, like, right before, you know, all of stand-up comedy was put on hold, I guess for the last year, I'd been doing this joke, and it was my first way of kind of dabbling in, like, kind of making jokes about the Trump administration, but without alienating Trump followers. Because okay. Also, I think that a lot of Trump supporters, like, I think that they expect liberal comedians in New York City to, you know, be know-it-alls, holier-than-thou, you know, like, and just to sort of pile on. So I had this joke, and I'm very proud of it. It's very silly, and I'm not going to, like, retell it, but I'll sort of tell you the concept of it.
Sure.
And it was just that, you know, at the office where I work, and this used to be the case. It no longer is, but for the sake of this joke, I always say that it is. at the office where I work, because it was like in this cool media building. Like it was a, you know, my company was owned by IAC, which has this like cool building, and it's like Match.com, College Humor, Daily Beast. Like it's like a very cool place to work. They, you know, if you're a fire warden, which I was, you're given the thing you have to wear to show that you're a fire warden is a red baseball hat.
Oh, nice.
And so I just do this whole joke about how it's like, you know, I'm like, in this current political climate, like a red baseball hat, like, I know I'm being misunderstood. And I know, like, I just do this whole thing about how, like, I'm perceived as a Trump supporter at work. And, you know, I'm too dumb to understand that people think I'm a Trump supporter. So I'm you know, so people are like, nice hat. And I'm like, thanks. And they're like, you know what that represents? And I'm like, yeah, safety. You know, like, just, and that we just like keep layering on and layering on, because I just don't get that they think I'm a Trump supporter, you know? And I'm like, you know, oh yeah. And I forget what the third beat, God, I haven't done stand up in eons. But the third beat is something like, you know, where it's like, it's like, I didn't think the person who I'm talking to in the joke is like, I didn't think people like you lived in New York City. Ooh. And I'm like, we're in every building on every floor and we're just trying to help. Which it's like, and I think it's nice because I've seen audiences who I think had Trump supporters in it enjoy the joke. I've seen liberals enjoy the joke. And it's like, okay, it is like the formula for my comedy is mostly making fun of me. And me being dumb or me not getting what's going on, you know, and I just think it's a pretty safe, not safe, but, you know, you put yourself in an appealing position to everyone and you don't alienate anyone.
Sure. And how's that been? And you mentioned in passing just before that you haven't done stand up in a bit. And I imagine a lot of that has to do with the coronavirus outbreak. So how's that been?
Oh, my God. I mean, it's so strange. Like there are some shows moved on to Zoom and they've done some shows have done a great job. I mean, Risk, the storytelling show and podcast, has been doing Zooms with huge audiences. Like I went to a reunion of Mr. Show, which is one of my favorite TV shows, on Zoom, and they did sketches on Zoom. Like, and I've watched one or two stand-up shows on Zoom. I was asked to do a few stand-up shows on Zoom and I was just like, I didn't have any interest in delivering jokes directly to my camera alone in my bedroom, you know? And I think, I mean, I've watched people do a great job of it. So like it can be done and I admire people who do it. I know that just for me, especially when the lockdown first started, I just felt like I was just trying to get through the day, you know, like I stopped working out. I couldn't do stand up anymore. Like I just was like, I still have my job. I'm doing my job from the corner of my bedroom and that's going to be enough for right now, you know? Yeah. But I've done some interview shows on Zoom where I just will talk about, you know, NYT Vows or about my candle podcast. And that's been actually really nice and like just sort of fun and chill. But yeah, it's very odd. And I mean, to be honest, I think that I might be done with live performing stand up.
Really?
Like, yeah, it's very, and it's been funny to like say that out loud, but yeah.
Is this an exclusive retirement announcement that we're getting here on the pod?
You did, yeah, you got the news, oh my God. Yeah, it's funny, like in the summer of 2017, I recorded my first stand-up album, Seen Better Days, which everyone can find on Spotify or iTunes or all over the place. And as I was recording that, a good friend of mine from childhood was dying of brain cancer. And so she passed away. I recorded it in late July. She passed away in mid-August. And I just stopped performing for a while, like that summer. Like, and after I recorded it, I wanted to give myself like a very much like a French August of like, I'm just chilling. But I just like, you know, then that fall and winter, I kind of went back to stand up and I just didn't enjoy it the way I used to, you know? And so, you know, and that was late 2017 into 2018. And so for a couple of years, I feel like I've been kind of slugging it out and continuing to perform. And it's, you know, it's sometimes it's great, but sometimes I'm just like, this doesn't speak to me the way it used to, you know? And so I don't know. I think this might be a good time because I haven't done stand up in 3 months. So like may as well just ride this into the sunset, I think. I mean, and we'll see, because I also wonder, like, if stand-up comes back, is it, you know, I mean, a lot, like, have you seen these pictures of, because of social distancing, some theaters where they've taken out, like, every other chair in
right.
the auditorium? Like,
it's very awkward looking.
It's so awkward, and, you know, I think you could watch a musical that way or a straight play, but, like, stand-up, like, the most important thing in stand-up is that you have a ton of people packed into a small space, ideally with a low ceiling, you know, like I just think... with coronavirus, like stand-up is, it's going to take a while for it to come back in a format that would be remotely enjoyable, you know? So yeah. And, you know, like, I think there's so many ways, so many different ways to be creative and have creative outlets. And so part of me is like, you know, I think maybe I'll just do more writing and, you know, focus on NYT Vows and my podcast. And, you know, I have a boyfriend of about 6 months and, you know, like, I think I'd rather spend my days off with him than in a basement of a bar, you know?
Sure. All that makes sense. It sounds like there is a high level of self-care involved as well. Just kind of moving away, figuring out what's not good for you anymore and
exactly.
Discarding that.
Yes, exactly. Which I think is such an important thing to do. And I think, you know, it can be hard, especially when, you know, you have this sort of creative dream. And, you know, like, I've been hustling in New York City in the comedy scene since I was 26 and I just turned 40. And yeah, I kind of was like, you know what? I think it's a good time to go. But yeah, like, it's, I think it can be hard to let yourself change your mind or let yourself feel like, okay, that was a cool time. I did that for all these years and now I'm going to pivot to something else. But you're exactly right. I think a lot of it is sort of the self-care, self-preservation, just like, you know, growing out of things.
Yeah. Wow. So I appreciate all of that personal information leaving out here. Thank you for the exclusive on the announcement.
Thank you for being my free therapist. Yeah. I haven't seen therapist in a minute, so it's nice.
So with that, with all that said, let's start talking a little bit about what's been going on in the world. You know, we've touched on coronavirus there a bit, but we'll probably focus more so on just the ongoing protests across the country. Just a few things. We did an episode last week where we kind of talked about George Floyd and the overall Black Lives Matter movement. And it's been weird to see, even by the time, you know, this episode drops, that even with the increased focus, you know, the national attention on everything that's been going on, we haven't really seen a downturn in violence. Mm-hmm. And by violence, I mean police violence. Mm-hmm. At a lot of these protests, despite a microscope being utilized now,
yeah,
to look at what's been going on, I feel like there's been an active, in some channels, an active attempt to really show what these protests are about, and that, you know, 99.9% of them are peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
Until police and riot gear show up.
Yeah.
And it's been, I think, a little bit of a relief to me to see that news organizations are starting to cover it that way, mm-hmm. which is not how they started coverage at all.
Yeah.
It was all about, you know, here's the chaos and the looting and blah, blah. That was always the top headline. And I think a lot of them have kind of realized, whether it was, you know, they came to terms with their own internal biases or mm-hmm. whatever. That, you know, they have a responsibility to portray these as exactly what they are. And they are peaceful protests of people asking not to be killed by police.
Exactly. I mean, and, you know, the press has an obligation to portray them in the way they did these silly protests, you know, in March in what the Michigan State House of like let me get cut my hair and, yep. you know, you're ruining my senior year. Like, I mean, I'm sorry, that is such small potatoes and it's shameful. And now, like, yeah, I mean, what I have heard from, I have numerous friends, you know, and I'm here in Brooklyn, I have numerous friends who've gone on a lot of protest marches and to rallies. I just went to one silent vigil in the park, which was what I felt like I needed to do because I get very anxious around groups of people. And especially like with a march, I just really am fearful of being trampled and or something happening. And especially because, I mean, it was happening and it was police escalation. I mean, police were using that tactic called like kettling, which I'd never heard of.
Yeah.
But it's basically like you block people in and attack them.
It's like herding animals.
Exactly. Yeah. I know. And I mean, and it seemed as though that was what the curfew was sort of about, was we'll make it illegal to be on the street. So then when you're on the street, we will justify our violence against you.
Absolutely.
Which is why I do feel like the removal of the curfew, I thought, was a hopeful sign of like, okay, maybe the police have said this is a PR nightmare. Also, this is just brutal and difficult for us to be constantly in these fights. But I know, I mean, I have a friend who lives near me in Brooklyn, and she and her 9-year-old son were looking out the window watching a peaceful protest and were very moved by it. And then something changed. And so she saw the like kettling happening. And she posted on Facebook. She's like, this is real. This is happening. It was just police, you know, blew everything up. And I know there was that march where, you know, they got the police trapped them on the Manhattan Bridge or the Brooklyn Bridge, I think.
I think it was Manhattan Bridge. Yep.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. My friend Amber was arrested in that protest and said, I mean, they were just like locked in basically. I mean, it's just so odd to me. I just think, wouldn't it make more like, I mean, and then you see footage. I just saw footage today of a KKK protest in, I forget which state, but you know, police are very hands off. They kind of let those guys walk around with their disgusting flags and swastikas. And it's like, why aren't police treating everyone like that? Like, why aren't they always sort of just like, it doesn't need to be adversarial, you know?
Yeah. I 100% agree. It's weird because it begs the question, like, if all these protesters showed up with AR-15s, what would the police do?
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems like when people storm, you know, state houses, you brought up the one in Michigan.
Yeah.
Police just stand by and do nothing.
Oh, yeah. And those people were terribly behaved. They were screaming in the faces. I mean, those people weren't, you know, and the protests that are happening now are, for the most part, completely, you know, calm. You know, no one is being confrontational with cops for the most part. Like, meanwhile, yeah, those Michigan protests that were about damn haircuts and nails getting done, those people were truly attacking the cops. Like, I mean, just the level. I mean, and that says so much right there. It's like, this is what they're marching for. You know, this is what Black Lives Matter is about.
Yep.
You know, is just the way that white people are treated so differently than Black people in this country. And yeah, I mean, and similar to what we talked about before with the need for better police training, they need so much implicit bias training. Like, how many cases have we seen where the cop is like, I felt like I was under attack. I felt like, you know, I was being threatened. And it's like, you think that because this person was Black, like, yeah. I know it's really hard to say that out loud and it sounds really disgusting, but that is what's going on. Like, you know, Trayvon Martin, a 13-year-old, like just young kids being perceived as older than they are and as threatening when they are not. It's like we need to talk to people about these implicit biases and the way they can, you know, even if you have that instinct to be able to talk yourself out of it and be like, oh, wait, okay. You know, like just I just think that a lot of cops seem to not be in touch with examining why they think the way things they think, you know, and trying to not just react from a place of fear and anger, but like, think about, think about why you're scared of this person and all of the meanings behind that and the fact that your entire life you've been living in a white supremacist nation and how that manifests in your actions.
Yeah, and I mean, part of me, I understand why it's tough to come to those realizations and reflect inwards. Mm-hmm. Totally get that. So I mean, we can fault them for sure, but I can see why, mm-hmm. at least. And I mean, they're human, right? Mm-hmm. And we all struggle with doing that. The problem is they're in a job that doesn't allow for that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Where they need to be held to a higher standard because they're there to protect people. And and it means all people. It doesn't mean white people only.
Exactly.
And it's... So I understand why it's so difficult to look inward and say, oh, maybe I've been upholding racist laws or I've been upholding a racist institution that we know you didn't make,
mm-hmm.
but we all live in.
Yes.
And we need to admit that it is what it is. And because otherwise nothing's going to change.
I know. There needs to be almost like a Socratic method for cops of like, do no harm. You know, like, I just think we hold doctors to a certain standard. We hold nurses to, you know, like,
right.
I mean, yeah, like my nurse friend was saying that just like so many nurses have dealt with violent, belligerent, scary people,
mm-hmm.
and they've never harmed them. You know,
right.
like there are ways to deal with, you know, to talk to your fellow human and to deal with your local society and to attempt to minimize harm and attempt to just try to help, you know, and it just seems like so many cops, I think they just see it as a sort of carte blanche, like, oh, isn't this fun? I get to play with guns. I was brave enough to be in the military. Here I am. You know, like, which that's also a very cruel thing to say. But but yeah, I mean, especially because of the militarization of local police forces, which I find so troublesome. But yeah, like, Exactly. I mean, everyone needs to do the work, and it's not easy to do because, you know, it's hard to see in yourself and it's embarrassing to admit. You know, I know years ago I had this article online about, it was like a storytelling piece, and it was, you know, I posted online as an article, and someone in the comments asked me why through in the piece I wrote, it was a true story from my life, I didn't specify anyone's race except for this one Indian couple who helped me. And she was like, you know, it's just weird. You don't talk about the race of the guy who mugged you. You don't talk about the race of your best friend. You don't talk about your own race. But for whatever reason, you use as a descriptor this Indian couple, you know, and like, oh, I like kind of shame spiraled. And I was like, oh, my God. It was really hard to get called out in the comments of my own article. But I was like, she's right. Why am I using that as an adjective when I didn't for anyone else? And what does it matter? You know, like, it just made me, I was like, yeah, I should either, everyone gets to a lengthier description of what they look like, or no one does. But like, why did I think that it mattered that this couple was Indian, you know?
Yeah. And even, I mean, I'm probably guilty of doing that as well, for sure. And even if you're portraying that particular character of a story in a positive light, the fact
positive.
That you, exactly. Yeah, you said they helped you.
Yes.
So even as a positive light though, you, by singling them out makes it seem like that's unusual.
Exactly.
That
yeah.
They would have done that.
I know. Or I think it was also sort of tokenizing and patronizing of like, and this Indian couple joined in the fray. Like, oh, they don't get to be people beyond being Indian. I couldn't say nice locals. All they get is Indian, you know? And yeah, like, but I remember, you know, I was so embarrassed. Like, it was an article that did really well for me. And I was like, oh, God, like in the comments, someone's kind of ripping me to shreds. And I'm, but like, you know, it really made me examine my own, yeah, biases and the way that I wield language and the way that I think of people, you know, even, yeah, people who are helpful, you know. And so it was embarrassing. Like, you know, it's hard to do the work. It's hard to see that you fucked up and try again, you know,
yeah.
But you have to. I mean, we're all figuring this out, you know, and I appreciate that in the past week on Instagram, you know, with a lot of like people trying to elevate people of color and black voices. You know, a lot of people have been saying like to, you know, they're like to the white community, just know that, you know, you can still, you know, just you're going to fuck up and that's OK, but don't be scared to try again and don't not try because you're scared of messing up.
I think there's a great resource, and I'll link to this in the footnotes of the episode. If you're serious about all this and you're looking to actually do some self-examination, a great place to start is a book called Me and White Supremacy by Layla F. Saad.
Mm.
She's a you know, author of the book. She hosts actually a podcast called Good Ancestor Podcast.
Mm.
But it's an examination of white supremacy in the country, breaks down a bunch of myths, and kind of forces you to look in the mirror as a white person. And takes a unique approach that it ends each chapter with like journal entry questions for you to take the time and look inwards and explain it. And look, you could do it on your own. You don't have to share the results with anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been a fascinating read so far. I'm not through it myself just yet, but I did pick that up on, you know, one of the lists that I had seen circulating around of ways to educate yourself. And it's been something that I've been working my way through. So we'll link to that for our listeners as well. I think it's a good start. Good starting place.
Yeah. That's great. Similarly, about 6 months ago, read White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo, which is excellent and really helpful in breaking down like why certain things are patronizing or offensive of like, oh, but I marched in the 60s or, you know, all lives matter or, you know, just, you know, and she has such a gentle touch. And, you know, I think my mom read it with her church, which I thought was awesome. Yeah. Like a suburban Boston church, just like, being like, okay, required reading White Fragility. And then I borrowed my mom's copy and stole it from her. But yeah, I mean, I think that was also a pretty good on-ramp for people. Like if they're not quite ready for, you know, the biography of Malcolm X or like when they, you know, if they still need some convincing to get out of their own head.
It's really funny you bring up White Fragility. So I'm going to, in a roundabout way, get back to it in a second. But I was on a meeting today with a number of coworkers. They're hundreds of us on a Zoom call, and they opened the floor to let our black colleagues just speak about their life experiences. And there was probably about, in the hour we were on, probably a dozen or so that were super brave and told these stories that had everybody in tears for the entire hour about their experiences, whether it's just being pulled over once a week, every week for a few months, driving in your own neighborhood, or seeing Confederate flags on business calls when you're visiting people, and how awkward that is.
Oh my God.
One of my coworkers took the time to explain something that kind of hit a note with me, because I've seen these two terms used interchangeably a lot, especially recently, and they're not interchangeable. And that's ally versus advocate. So she took the time to explain the difference between being an ally versus being an advocate. And as she explained that, I realized that being an ally is actually pretty easy, because at its base level, it's really just about saying the right things. It can almost be performative. That's another word we're hearing a lot right now, where you're just posting on, you know, you blacked out your social media on Blackout Tuesday, and that's it, right?
Yep, so, and you're like, enough!
And that's it, and I'm done, right? And so that's what being an ally is you're supportive, but you're not actively doing anything. And being an advocate is harder. It means you're actually putting in the work and actively applying what you've learned to support, whether it's, you know, Black Lives Matter or whatever your cause is. It's putting your money where your mouth is what being an advocate's all about. She was much more nuanced and said it a lot better than I just did, but that is the gist of it. And so I guess in the interest of doing just that, I've decided that on this episode, I'm going to buy ebook copies of White Fragility for 10 listeners.
Oh, that's great.
So if you're listening to this, DM me on social media, whether it's at my personal account at KevW, D-U-B-Y-A, or at the, you know, the podcast account, drinking_libpod. That's on Twitter and Instagram. DM me, just send me your email address. That's all you need to send me. And I will gift you a copy through Amazon, so you can read it either on your computer or through the Kindle app or smartphone, tablet, etc. Good book to start with. And this is something I want to continue to do. I'll probably do this as often as my wallet allows me to. But I want to start with this book in particular, because it is called White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism.
Yeah.
And it's got an uncomfortable title for a lot of people.
Oh, I know.
Right?
I know. I remember the first time I saw it in a bookstore in Chelsea Market. Oh my God, remember when we used to be able to go to bookstores and walk among humans?
It sounds like a decade ago.
I know, seriously. I was like, oh, the halcyon days of yore. But I remember seeing it and thinking to myself, like, wow, props to the publisher for going with what I assume was the original title. And because I could see so many publishers being like, no. Like, you've got to tone this down. It's got to be like, you know, like examining your biases or like something a little bit like softer. And I mean, and even the cover design is very in your face. Like, it's really, it's a great book. And I really admire that. You know, I mean, once you get into it, I think she kind of does take you by the hand, but she also, you know, pulls no punches and she doesn't treat you like you're a dum-dum. You know, I think a lot of people who think, you know, Blue Lives Matter or All Lives Matter, I just don't think they fully get what they're saying, you know, or like, so I do think that White Fragility can be a great, I mean, and that's me being generous and kind to that community, but like, I think White Fragility, like, it's such a great book, and because it really hits on all of the different things of, like, you know, the weaponization of white women's tears and white people sort of centering things around themselves, and just a great on-ramp into unlearning a lot of the shit that you learned as a kid and in adulthood.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, if you don't know what this book is, you want a copy, you're interested in, you know, becoming a better person, an anti-racist person, hit me up on social media and we'll start there. If you're way ahead of me, like Selena is, you had a copy, you've read it, you know, kudos to you, first of all. And second, go ahead and buy your friend or family member that needs to see something like that a copy. Give them your copy. Just spread it around. Again, just like the other title we mentioned earlier, it's a great start. Mm-hmm. To opening up some very difficult discussions and some very hard reflections in the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
So, really happy you brought that title up.
yeah. I know it's been nice to get so many good book recommendations and also to then buckle down. Like, I'd always heard about Ta-Nehisi Coates' We Were 8 Years in Power.
Yep.
And I've been meaning to read it forever, but finally last week I bought about a few books that I'm excited to dive into that I've just been meaning to get to. And I'm like, you know what? Like, the time is now. And I'm embarrassed that I hadn't before. But yeah, I felt really lucky to get my mom's copy of White Fragility, and really cool to see my mom's notes in the margins. Like,
oh, that's really nice.
I know. I think that's my favorite thing about like sharing books with friends. And this is, and I'm an old school Luddite. I like real hard copy books. But just to see what passages resonated with your friend or your family member, you know, and it was nice to see, you know, because I think my mom is such a wonderful woman and is very wise. And it was just nice to see her margin notes, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's a great place for everybody to start. And for everybody, I mean, for the white people listening that are looking to make some change in their own life and, mm-hmm. you know, reevaluate what's been going on in their own lives and help any way they can. So we'll start there, probably make that a pretty regular segment where we'll talk about a new resource that we can work with so we can all work to be advocates rather than just allies here.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a little bit about just some good signs we're seeing across the country. So not everything is dire. And, you know, you mentioned earlier about the protests, you know, particularly in the Manhattan area and the other boroughs, and just normal good things would be things like the DA refusing to prosecute people that are arrested at the protests for, you know, nonviolent offenses, which is great. Every city should be doing that at this point. Removing curfews is a good sign, with an asterisk that I am wary that it's just a PR move.
Mm-hmm.
And we should always be wary about that. Keep an eye on it. We did have seen a number of states and cities who are now calling to reallocate resources to better help their communities. So you might see this argued as defund the police, which is the current slogan. That's probably the one that's going to stick and be used as a cudgel by Republicans.
Exactly. I mean, my dad, yeah.
But for those of you that are hearing it and don't know what it means, at face value, you might just think it means getting rid of police officers. That is not what it means. It means taking away responsibilities from police officers that really should never have been theirs to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean things like dealing with homeless populations. Police mm-hmm. really aren't trained for that. They're not trained to be dealing with mental health issues. They're not trained to be dealing with autistic people. You know, how many times we've seen a number of police murders of autistic people. They just didn't know how to handle the situation.
Yeah,
and it just escalated. So taking that kind of stuff away from them, let them focus strictly on violent crime.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe not even having them do traffic stops anymore. There's a separate department. And there should just be an ever, you know, there'll still be police. It's just going to take a different form.
Mm-hmm.
So the people that are responding to a mental health call aren't coming with a gun as their number one tool
mm-hmm.
or a taser. They're coming with an understanding of psychiatry,
mm-hmm.
psychology, and we'll be able to talk through these and de-escalate in a way that simply showing up with a gun immediately escalates things.
Oh, immediately. Exactly. I mean, also, I feel like the hilarious irony is like a knowledge of psychology. Finally, like some of these liberal arts grads are going to get jobs.
There you go.
You know, if they're like psych majors and they need to, and they do some training, and then it would be a great, you know, like it truly would be a great job for someone with a liberal arts degree in psych or, you know, but I mean, that's the thing. Exactly. Like I was just reading that, you know, in 35 states in America, it is legal for a police officer to have consensual sex, supposedly right. consensual sex with a person that they've arrested. Like,
why? Why is that even on the books, first of all? Like in that.
Like, what? That's the weirdest law to be.
How often was this happening that you had to put it in writing?
Exactly. And props to the 15 states that were like, no dice, you know, But I mean, it's funny because I finally went for a run the other day for the first time in months, and I was thinking about this law and just the inherent power imbalance of mm-hmm. a police officer and anyone else, you know, much less the person who is in their paddy wagon or in their cop car in the back. Like, this is never going to be consensual. I mean, in the same way that like Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, you can never blame Monica for that. I'm sorry.
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. Bill Clinton was the fucking president of the United States of America. Like, there are inherent power structures here. So exactly, when the cops show up to any scenario, because they have somewhat like impunity and a gun, no matter what goes down, there is fear in the person, you know, who is being responded to. You know, there are murder machines suddenly on the scene. Like, there could be, you know, immediate violence and destruction. Like, it just really throws, you can't, you know, a cop should never be responding yet to, like, you know, a severely autistic person having an incident in the street. Like,
yeah,
I would think cops would be psyched to be like, yeah, we don't have to try to deal with this. Like, they don't know how to do this. It's not good for anyone.
Yeah, it's not good for the cops either. Mm-hmm. You know, so like this, I feel is the way things need to shift drastically, mm-hmm. because none of these proposals, like the defund the police's proposals, are not anti-cop in nature.
Yeah.
You know, there's no reason why, and I think it was one of our guys last week who said, you know, there's no reason why two things can't be true at once.
Yes.
You know, so, you know, we can take some of these responsibilities off of a police officer's plate, put them with someone who's highly specialized to deal with that.
Exactly.
And let police officers do their jobs, what they are hired for.
Exactly. I mean, that's one thing. And I mean, you know me, you know, historically, I hate Bernie Sanders. And, you know, I've spoken about it pretty openly. But I've got to say, I've been impressed by him recently in that, like, he said, you know, first of all, we need to pay cops more so that it doesn't end up just becoming sort of the job. You know, I mean, similar to teachers, it's like these people work with the public. You want this to be a job for which they feel like they are fairly compensated. And you want to be, you know, people to get into this career path who are of all different types and mm-hmm. all different mindsets and, you know, like, and who maybe are getting into it to do good things, you know? But also, yeah, I mean, like, I think that's an important thing to express about the notion of defund the police. It's, you know, it's like, no, have there be more sort of niche specialties of helping your community than just cops, you know, mm-hmm. like. And I would think cops want that too. I mean, I sometimes would see cops, you know, dealing with, interacting with homeless people on the subway. And I would just feel like this isn't good for either of them. Like, this homeless person is being harassed. They're not being given any resources. They're just being told to wake up, get off the train.
Right.
Okay. That doesn't help them at all, you know? And the cop also, I'm sure, is like, this is how I'm serving my community by harassing.
I could be doing anything else right now.
Exactly. But I'm riding the subway just, you know, waking people up from a pleasant slumber to make them get out of the train. And then I'm going to continue on the train. They're probably just going to get on the next car. And like,
absolutely.
This is not helpful or useful, you know? I appreciate you explaining the notion of defund the police. Cause I think, you know, I do think it will be used as a cudgel. I fear that, you know, similar to Nixon's run in, you know, what was it, 68 or like, just the idea that, you know, I think Trump will try to sort of brand himself as the law and order guy. And
he's tweeting about it a lot.
Exactly. So, yeah. And I fear that the Democrats are playing right into his hand, or the super duper left Democrats of like, yeah, abolish the police, defund the police. Like, that's how you get Republicans to latch on to a guy who's a monster maniac, but they think that he's the only one who believes in, you know, there being cops.
Right. Yeah. I share that concern. It's an argument I was having with a group of friends via text today. We haven't come to any super definitive conclusions yet, so I'll probably save it for a future episode as we dive a little deeper and do some more research into both sides of the branding of defunding the police. Because you can make the argument either way, like you just did, which is essentially it's the branding is the issue, not the policies itself. But the way you're phrasing it inherently is going to turn some people off.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. My friend Jackie and I were on her roof the other night. She has a roof. And now that, like, I feel like it's safe to, like, meet up with a friend on a roof 6 feet apart and there's a breeze, you know, which, I mean, oh, God, it felt like a dream to be up there with a friend. But yeah, we were talking about, like, what are other slogans that would get across the nuance a little better than defund the police, you know? And she was like, maybe police the police. but yeah, which I was like, demilitarize or reform or, you know, just like something to show that. For many people, we don't mean get rid of police,
right.
But we mean, you know, change their responsibilities and have more resources for people. I mean, you always hear about schools, public schools, their budgets being slashed. And you never hear about that for fucking cops. Like, why do cops get all the guns and, you know, things they want, but we can't have music in certain public schools? Like, what the heck?
Yeah. It is crazy, one, that education is always the first thing on the chopping block, which would actually improve a lot of these outcomes because, you know, higher education means you're typically getting better jobs, you're better paid, which means you are not desperate for food or money.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which leads to a decrease in crime.
Exactly. I know. I mean, the one good thing that de Blasio has ever done in his entire career. Oh, God, he is really asleep at the wheel right now.
Yeah, this is a low bar right now. So.
I know. Yeah. I believe it was like Kindergarten for All, or he was great about early intervention in New York City and having it. Mm-hmm. And for that to be, I can't even remember, but like
it might have been pre-K. I mean, yeah. Around, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But yeah, like that's where the seeds are planted. And that's like, if you, it's just like, that's where you're kind of set up for success. And also that enables the parents, if they have a free public option, great. The parents can now also be working and they're making money. Like it's just good for everyone. I mean, that's why I often just really disagreed with people whose platform was, you know, free college for all. Cause I just felt like, No, we got to get it earlier. Like, the focus has to be earlier in life as far as helping out people because, you know, I think free college for all could be cool, but to me, the priority has got to be either K-12 and before K-12.
Yeah, so when you hear people saying that's a systemic problem, like, this is exactly what we're talking about, that it's not just police. Like, this is an education, it's a housing, it's a job market issue as well. It's prevalent everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it's all interconnected, so really just tackling one, like, we have to walk and chew gum at the same time. Like, you can't just be doing one of these.
I know.
And then, just so I can do justice to that argument that I was bringing up before about the branding versus, you know, some of the other the counter argument to that and just going with defund the police, a friend of mine made this very good point where he said, when I hear people say exactly what we were just saying, that the branding needs to change, he's like, what it means to me is this: we need to mold our message to white Americans and tell blacks to just deal with it because they don't matter as much. And I totally can see that as well. So when I said there's more to be researched and learned about here, like, that's what I mean. That at face value, I was like, yeah, no, obviously, just change the naming of it. Like, that's easy fix. And then that kind of opened my eyes a bit to there could be a there's not could be. There is another argument to be made here.
Yeah, totally. So. Yeah, there's so much catering to white fragility and white fear. And yeah, I've seen some great conversations on Twitter about people being like, you know, the notion of defund the police really came from activists and people who are sort of on the ground. So, yeah, I mean, I am trying to be more, you know, as I've sort of changed the way I engage on Twitter, and I'm just trying to be more open to understanding and thinking about, like, yeah, initially I sort of thought that the phrase defund the police was a bad call, but, you know, but it's like, no, I think you got to be open to being like, no, maybe I was wrong, or maybe I'm not quite sure, so I'm gonna sit this one out, you know. Right. I mean, we just the other day in my family on our email chain we're having a conversation about defund the police, and I was just trying to explain what is meant by that, and, you know, and then, you know, finally I said to my family, I was like, to be honest, I don't fully know a ton about what this means. And I think it means different things to different people. And, you know, it's fine to kind of not weigh in or have an opinion about it if you don't fully know about it. And I've been trying to really observe that myself more so lately.
Yeah. And it's something that I think Democrats, you know, we've seen Democrats hammering home, oh, you need to vote, you need to vote. Well, they need to really figure out what this means and make it palatable to the masses. To get turnout. So more to come on that particular topic. You know, it's funny because we started this, I was saying, let's cover some positive things, and we kind of that went off the rails fast.
I know.
But here's a positive thing I saw just before we started recording. NASCAR has banned Confederate flags from being at its races.
I saw that. I'm impressed and surprised.
I am very surprised. Just go to their official Twitter account where they made the announcement. Just read the cesspool of comments there.
Oh, God.
Or don't do it to yourself. Just take my word for it.
Seriously. Oh, God.
In the interest of self-care there. Don't even bother.
Preserve your sanity.
Yeah. But seeing that kind of warms my heart. Seeing the turnout, the consistent turnout, the spread, seeing this in every state in the country, these protests has been amazing to watch.
Oh, I mean, the real acceptance and, you know, I mean, I know like Fox News thinks that Black Lives Matter is a terrorist organization. And it's been nice to see some people I know who are Republicans who did share that view now actually change their mind, you know, like I, you know, I've talked to a lot of friends and family of mine about going to a vigil, and people who I thought were going to be like, oh, God, you know, were actually really impressed and proud and glad that I was supporting the cause. And I was just surprised that they were so supportive. So it's nice. It does seem like there's sort of a real shift. And it's nice for the white community to show up for the Black community, you know, like, I mean, I think there's a lot of, you know, I think we all worry about like feeling as though we're being performative or, you know, like, or does this seem, you know, is it the Black community's fight to battle, you know, battle?
Right. You're trying to avoid that white savior type, strike that balance. Right.
Yeah. But I think, you know, I think it's it is meaningful for it to be like, no, this is, everyone's got skin in the game here. You know, like racism is not for the Black community to solve, to deal with and to solve. No, no, no. Racism is our, is the white, it's the white man's problem. And it is ours to solve. And ours, on Sunday I went to this really wonderful, my friend Shanali Bomek organized a sort of conference Zoom with this guy who was very well known in the world of racial dynamics and racism. His name's Tim, I want to say Tim Willis or something. I'm so sorry, I can't remember. But it was a wonderful conversation, and it was just like reaffirming to hear like, white people, like, this is your problem to solve. I mean, it is, you know, like the Black man has been bearing the burden for so long. And we had these breakout groups, and we were sort of brainstorming ways to fight racism. And I was just thinking, like, it needs to be made in the same way that smoking in movies and cinema, especially in the 40s and 50s and 60s, was made to seem very cool.
Yeah.
Making crummy racist jokes or whatever needs to be social suicide.
And, yeah, absolutely.
You know, and it cannot be the kind of thing where like, oh, because there's a Black person there, someone told a racist joke and it was awkward because the Black person was there. No, no, no. Even in an all white gathering, if a racist joke is told, it needs to be on the white people there to be like, no, 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 that's not okay. You know, there needs to be no safe space for that.
That's like the bare minimum, right? The bare minimum everyone can do.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, I too have been kind of surprised at the level of support from people. I wasn't sure where they kind of stood on the whole Black Lives Matter movement. But I mean, Black Lives Matter right now is more popular than our president, percentage wise. So pretty safe bet the people around you, the majority of them are supportive right now. And that's a great thing to see. You know, I went to a vigil yesterday. My wife and I went, and you know, it was just an hour long, but was, you know, we lined the street through town, and I live in a very, very white town. And I was really wondering what turnout was going to be at this vigil, and was pleasantly surprised. I mean, the organizer said it was like 400 people. It's not a huge town, mind you. So 400 people, though, looked pretty impressive just up and down this street. And, you know, majority white people there, just by nature of the demographics of the town. And the number of cars that kind of drove past in support, honking and waving and, you know, putting their fist out the window was awesome to see. We had maybe two or three people with negative reactions, but that was the tiniest sliver of a minority. Yeah. That was fantastic. And I was super proud of my little town that I've only lived in for a few months right now.
I know. Oh, welcome to Massachusetts.
Yeah, thank you.
Dunkin' Donuts for everyone.
I guess on that note, we are approaching kind of the close of our episode here. So, Selena, is there anything you want to plug for our listeners?
Yes. So the thing that I am actively doing still is NYT Vows, which is a Twitter and an Instagram, and it's literally NYTVOWS. And I just sort of mock, I pretend to be the New York Times wedding section so that I can mock, you know, the wedding industrial complex and WASPs and New York social culture. So that one I still am sort of cranking with it, you know, but trying to be tasteful and know the moment. You know, I sometimes I'm not as I don't do as much as I used to on there. But and then right now I'm not making new episodes right now, but my Candle podcast has I think, a total of like 16 episodes out. It's called Two Wick Minimum. It's on iTunes and all those great places. And they're really short, lovely episodes where we just literally talk about candles. And I know you probably think, can you have a podcast about candles? You can. It's America's favorite and only podcast about candles. I'm hoping that once, maybe when things go back to a little bit, you know, we can all be out in the world a little more, I might get the energy and drive to make more episodes. But right now, actually, I just posted on the 2 Wick Minimum Instagram a great tally of Black-owned candle makers.
And, oh, awesome.
Yeah. So there's, I mean, and there's so many, but this is just an assortment that I, you know, found online. And so follow them and buy their candles. It's all great stuff. I have a candle that I just ordered from Harlem Candle Company, who are fantastic, based in New York, Black-owned. And their scents are wonderful. I've smelled them before. And then, yeah, just my regular old Twitter, which I'm not doing a ton of tweeting these days, but it's just my full name, Selena Kopick, S-E-L-E-N-A-C-O-P-P-O-C-K. And then, yeah, I think that's all I have to promote.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining.
Yeah, Kevin, thank you so much for having me. This has been
always
a lovely
a pleasure.
Conversation.
Yeah, hope to have you back soon.
Yes.
We've got a few things to promote on our end. First and foremost, last week we kind of gave a list of links on our website, www.drinkingliberallypod.com, resources for you to learn more and take an active stance in being anti-racist. So I'm going to plug that again. I will continue to put those links on every post we make on the website for each new episode. So make sure you check those out. A number of the resources are free. There are some academic papers that have been shared in PDF form, some audio, some video. I'll also share out some links from some of my favorite podcasters who cover movies, the We Hate Movies podcast. One of their guys posted a Twitter thread of Black-directed, Black-acted movies.
That's great.
And I think it's definitely worthwhile to start working your way down that list and, you know, broadening horizons a bit. Other than that, though, you can follow me on social media at KevW. That's D-U-B-Y-A. And you can follow the podcast at drinking_libpod on Twitter and Instagram. And be sure to check out the aforementioned website, www.drinkingliberallypod.com. On that note, all I have to say is remember to wash your damn hands. There's still a pandemic out there, and Black Lives Matter. Cheers.